This is Audible.
Random House Audiobooks presents Star Wars, The New Jedi Order, Agents of Chaos 1, Heroes Trial, by James Luceno. If the system's primary was distressed by the events that had transpired on and about the fourth closest of its brood, it betrayed nothing to the naked eye. Saturating local space with golden radiance, the star was as unperturbed now as it was before the battle had begun. Only the conquered world had suffered. Regions that had once been green, blue, or white appeared ash gray or reddish brown. Smoke chimneyed from immolated cities and billowed from tracts of fire-stormed evergreen forests. Deep within the planet's shroud of cinder and debris moved the warship most responsible for the devastation. The vessel was a massive ovoid of Yorick coral, its scabrous black surface relieved in places by bands of smoother stuff, lustrous as volcanic glass. In the pits that dimpled the coarse stretches hid projectile launchers and plasma weapons. Other, more crater-like depressions housed the laser-gobbling Dovin basals that both drove the vessel and shielded it from harm. Farther removed from the battle floated a smaller vessel, black as well, but faceted and polished smooth as a gemstone. From a roost in the underside of its angular snout, a gaunt figure, cross-legged on cushions, beheld these sights without cheer or regret. Necessity had engineered the destruction. What had been done needed to be done. An acolyte stood in the rear of the command roost, relaying updates as they were received by a slender living device fastened to his right inner forearm by six insectile legs.
"Victory is ours, Eminence. Our air and ground forces have overwhelmed the principal population centers. However, our arrival does not please Commander Tla, Eminence. He does not dismiss out of hand the need for sacrifice, but he asserts that the campaign has been successful thus far without the need for religious overseers. He fears that our presence will only confound his task."
"Commander Tla fails to grasp that we engage the enemy on different fronts," Harar said. "Any opponent can be beaten into submission, but compliance is no guarantee that you have won him over to your beliefs."
Harar, a male of middle years, rose and moved to the lip of the roost's polygonal transparency, where he stood with three-fingered hands clasped at the small of his back, the missing digits having been offered in dedication ceremonies and ritual sacrifices as a means of escalating himself. A headcloth, patterned and significantly knotted, bound his long black tresses. The back of his neck showed vibrant markings etched into skin stretched taut by prominent vertebrae. The planet turned beneath him.
"What is this world called?" he asked.
"Obra Sky, Eminence."
"Obra Sky," Harar mused aloud.
A herald of lesser station appeared in the roost, offering salute by snapping his fists to opposite shoulders.
"Belikyo, Eminence. I bring word that the captives have been gathered."
"How many?"
"Several hundred, of diverse aspect. Do you wish to oversee the selection for the sacrifice?"
Harar squared his shoulders and adjusted the fall of his elegant robes.
"I am most eager to do so."
The door's diaphanous seal opened on an immense hold packed to the bulkheads with captives taken on and in the skies above Obra Sky. Harar's entourage of personal guards and attendants moved into the hold, followed by the priest himself perched atop a levitated cushion, one leg folded beneath him, the other dangling over the edge. Well illuminated by bioluminescent patches that rashed the walls and ceiling, the hold had been sectioned off into a score of separate inhibition fields arranged in two parallel rows and maintained by larger Dovin basals. Pressed shoulder to shoulder in each field stood scholars and researchers from a host of worlds, humans and others, Bothan, Bith, Quarren, and Kamasi, all jabbering at once in a welter of tongues. Harar hovered on the cushion, surveying the scene with hooded eyes. Some of the prisoners begged for mercy as Harar's cushion carried him toward the closest inhibition field, but most fell silent in stark apprehension. He regarded them indifferently, until his eyes happened on a furred humanoid from whose bulging brow emerged a pair of ringed, cone-shaped horns. Bare hands and feet were hardened by physical labor, but the creature's limpid eyes belied a deep intelligence. The humanoid wore a sleeveless sack-like garment that fell raggedly to the knees.
"What species are you?"
Harar asked in flawless basic.
"I am Gotal."
Harar indicated the sackcloth.
"Your attire befits a penitent more than a scholar. Which are you?"
"I am both, and I am neither,"
the Gotal said with purposeful ambiguity.
"I am an Hakig priest."
Harar twisted spiritedly on the cushion to address his retinue.
"Good fortune! We have a holy one in our midst."
His gaze returned to the Gotal.
"Tell me something of your religion, Hakig priest."
"What interest could you have in my beliefs?"
"Ah, but I, too, am a performer of rituals. As one priest to another, then."
"We Hekig believe in the value of simple living,"
the Gotal said plainly.
"Yes, but to what end? To ensure bountiful harvests? To escalate yourself? To secure a place in the afterlife?"
"Virtue is its own reward."
Harar adopted a puzzled look.
"Your gods have said as much?"
"It is simply our truth, one among many."
"One among many. And what of the truth the Yuzhong Vong bring you? Aver that you recognize our gods, and I may be inclined to spare your life."
The Gotal stared at him dispassionately.
"Only a false god would thirst so for death and destruction."
"Then it's true. You fear death."
"I have no fear of a death suffered in the cause of truth, the alleviation of suffering, or the abolishment of evil."
"Suffering?"
Harar leaned menacingly toward him.
"Let me tell you of suffering, priest. Misery is the mainstay of life. Those who accept this truth understand that death is the release from suffering. That's why we go willingly to our deaths, for we are the resigned ones."
He scanned the captives and raised his voice.
"We ask no more of you than we do ourselves, to repay the gods for the sacrifices they endured in creating the cosmos. We offer flesh and blood so that their work might endure."
"Our god demands no tribute other than good acts,"
the Gotal rejoined.
"Acts that raise calluses,"
Harar said in disdain.
"If this is all that is expected of you, it's no wonder your gods have abandoned you in your time of need."
"We have not been abandoned. We still have the Jedi."
Murmurs of fellowship moved through the throng of captives.
"These Jedi are your gods?"
Harar asked. The Gotal took a moment to answer.
"The Jedi Knights are the trustees of peace and justice."
"And this force I have heard about, how would you describe it?"
The Gotal grinned faintly.
"It is something you will never touch.
Although if I didn't know better, I would swear you were sprung from its dark side." Harar's interest was piqued.
"The force contains both light and dark?"
"As do all things."
"And which are you with regard to us? Are you so sure you embody the light?"
"I know only what my heart teaches."
Harar deliberated.
"Then this struggle is more than some petty war. This is a contest of gods in which you and I are but mere instruments."
The Gotal held his head high.
"That may be so, but the final judgment is already decided."
Harar sneered.
"May that belief comfort you in your final hour, priest, which, I assure you, is close at hand."
Again he addressed the multitudes.
Up until now, your species have faced only Yuzhong Vong warriors and politicians. As of today, know that the true architects of your destiny have arrived.
He beckoned his entourage forward.
This force is a strange, stubborn faith. If ever we are to rule here, we need to understand just how it binds these myriad beings together. And we need to vanquish the Jedi Knights once and for all.
In a galaxy fraught with wonders, the convergence of columnar tree trunks and forking branches that supported the Wookiee city of Rukwaro enjoyed a place of special honor. Viewed from above against its backdrop of fathomless forest, the city appeared to have been rescued from the planet's harsh underworld and submitted to Kashyyyk's scudded sky as an example of nature and technology in consummate poise. At the outskirts of the city, distant from the circular buildings that rose from its spongy floor, atop a massive fallen branch that spanned several treetops, a ceremony was in progress, enacted in observance of nature's timeless cycle of life and death. The participants, including 24 Wookiees and humans of both sexes, were arranged in a loose circle around a wooden circular table. Some stood, others sat on their haunches, but all wore solemn expressions, save for the group's only non-living members, the droids C-3PO and R2-D2, whose alloy countenances remained in all circumstances essentially neutral.
We gather in memory of Chewbacca, honorable son, beloved mate, devoted father, loyal friend and comrade in arms, champion and clan uncle to all of us in spirit, if not in the traditional way.
The Wookiee speaker was called Ralrachin, though C-3PO had often heard him referred to simply as Ralra. He was tall and aged, even for his arboreal species, but it wasn't the graying muzzle that distinguished him so much as his curious speech impediment. On any other occasion, C-3PO would have been tasked to serve as translator and interpreter, but none of the humans present had need of his polyglot faculties that particular morning.
In Chewbacca, the defiant flame burned brightest, Ralra went on, black nose twitching and long arms dangling at his sides. On Kashyyyk or far afield on distant worlds, he was never less than courageous and incorruptible. A Wookiee with heart enough for 10 and eager strength enough for 50.
Chewbacca had died 6 standard months earlier during an ill-fated rescue attempt on the planet Cernpedal, after it had been targeted for destruction by the Yuzhong Vong. The fact that it hadn't been possible to retrieve his body was a source of sorrow to all, for had Chewbacca been returned to Kashyyyk, a funeral would have been held, though for honored family members only. Close to Ralra squatted Chewbacca's father, Atachikkuk, along with Chewbacca's auburn-furred sister, Calibo. Alongside them sat Chewbacca's widow, Malatabak, and their son, Lump Waru. Waru for short. Interspersed among the Wookiee contingent stood assorted friends, kin-brothers, cousins, nieces and nephews, Lobaka, among the latter, a Jedi Knight. The humans numbered only 6, Master Luke, Mistress Leia, Master Han, and the 3 Solo offspring, Anakin, Jason and Jaina. Master Luke's wife, Mara, might have attended if a sudden relapse in her mysterious malady hadn't forced her to remain on Coruscant.
Natural curiosity compelled Chewbacca to leave Kashyyyk at an early age, but, like all of us, he was soon enslaved by the Empire. Fortunately, Chewbacca regained his freedom at the hands of a man of like strength and honor, our revered brother, Han Solo. And in the company of Han Solo, to whom he had pledged his life, Chewbacca was to play a crucial role in the rebellion and in the events that led eventually to the downfall of Emperor Palpatine.
C-3PO focused his photoreceptors on Master Han, whose eyes were red-rimmed and narrowed, and whose right hand Mistress Jaina had taken between her own.
Chewbacca went on to become a soldier in the New Republic,
Rara said. He aided in Kashyyyk's liberation after the Battle of Endor. But he remained first and foremost devoted to Han Solo, as friend and indebted protector, and as guardian to Han Solo's spouse and three children. Rara turned to Han. It was Chewbacca's honor to have been able to come to his friend's rescue on several occasions, even as recently as the crisis involving the Yvetha, when he freed Han Solo from imprisonment aboard a Yvethan warship. As constructed, C-3PO was incapable of shedding tears or enduring heartbreak, as it was called, but his programming did allow him to experience sorrow of a sort, if not nearly to the depth experienced by humans and other living beings, and it was suddenly clear that sorrow was the source of a flutter that continued to plague him. Try as he might, he could not summon a sound thought, and with each glance at Master Han, his dismay increased.
Now, in the same way as the branches of the Rocher seek out and support one another, Chewbacca's spirit merges with and gives sustenance to our own, strengthening us for the challenges we have yet to confront.
Warfare had figured in C-3PO's existence for so long that a new invasion shouldn't have come as a surprise, but there was something different about the Yuuzhan Vong and the harrowing war they were waging on a galactic scale. It wasn't merely that they didn't distinguish among species or among worlds, New Republic, Imperial Remnant, or non-aligned, or even that their biotic warships and weapons packed such awesome destructive power. What worried C-3PO most was that this most recent conflict was one in which not even droids were spared, and that meant that, like it or not, he might yet arrive at a true understanding of grief and death. The circular table was covered with foodstuffs, bowls of shichibic broth, barbecued trachern ribs, forest honey cakes, flasks of wine, juices and liquors. Humans and Wookiees were conversing in groups, recounting tales of Chewbacca's exploits that brought laughter, tears, or moments of sober reflection. Han sat dejectedly on a short-legged stool, resting his elbows on his knees. Malatabak and several other members of Chewbacca's family approached him. Mala was cradling a meter-long wooden box. Han Solo, she said, smiling down at him. We want you to have this. Han's brows knitted. He set the box down on the stool and unlatched its finely wrought metal clasp. Inside was a beautifully carved bowcaster, its marked and blemished skeleton stock polished to a deep brown gleam. I recognize this, Han said, nodding. He compressed his lips to trap a moan, fighting to escape him. It's one of the first I ever saw him make. Chewbacca fashioned it shortly after we married, Mala said, while you were here. He fashioned better in his time, but this one retains the warmth and power of him. Han hefted the weapon. I feel it. He hugged Mala, his head barely reaching her chin. I'll treasure it. Mala said, Jaudril, Chewbacca's cousin, is wondering when you and your family will be returning to Coruscant. Han shrugged. I hadn't thought about it. Tomorrow sometime, I suppose. Mala lowed in elaboration. Jaudril asks because she and Dryanta need a small measure of time to prepare. Han's features mirrored his bewilderment. Prepare for what? Are they coming to Coruscant with us? Chewbacca's father, Atachik, explained.
Jaudril and Dryanta are arranging the feast for Waru and Lobaka's farewell. They will be assuming Chewbacca's life debt.
Han's jaw came unhinged. He glanced from one Wookiee to the next in rising dismay.
But you can't. Chewie's dead. All debts are off.
Atachik was not at all happy with Han's response.
Death may have extinguished my son's defiant flame, but our debt to you continues until yours is extinguished.
No, I can't accept this. Chewie saved my life 10 times over. He died saving Anakin's life.
Atachik rumbled, nearly showing his fangs.
A life debt is just that.
Mala, too, was glowering at Han.
You would not defame Chewbacca's memory by refusing to allow his debt to be honored.
Han stared at her, mouth ajar.
Right, right, he said at last. I'd cut off my arm before I'd dishonor Chewie's memory in any way. You know that. It's just that I'm not ready. Chewie's still alive for me. I can't just allow him to be replaced. You gotta understand that. He was more than a protector. He was my closest friend.
The Wookiees exchanged sympathetic looks. He clings to his memory of my husband, Mala remarked sadly.
He needs time,
Atticitcook growled, somehow without making it sound menacing.
That's it,
Han said, grasping at straws. I just need time. After what seemed an eternity, Chewbacca's father nodded his head.
Then time will grant you. The life debt involves more than simply providing shelter from bodily harm. It suckers the spirit as well.
Han saw the truth of it.
I want that to go on.
Mala put her huge paws on his shoulders. Then it shall.
Holographic images of star systems and entire galactic sectors pirouetted in a blue-gray shaft of projected light. Flashing overlays showed hyperspace lanes that linked far-flung regions of space.
It disheartens me to have to subject you to inert technology, Eminence.
Commander Tala's tactician, Raff, apologized.
But we have yet to discover a way to separate the data from the metallic shells that sustain them.
The tactician raised a bony, gloved hand to the animated hologram.
As you can see, Eminence, we have here nothing less than a portrait of the galaxy. In broad strokes, to be sure, and yet detailed enough to aid us in our push toward the core.
Roth continued.
Obraskai dedicated itself to preserving cultural documents in the original languages and access formats. Once rendered in Vilip speech, these documents will yield a wealth of information regarding the psychological makeup of many of these species, and that knowledge will be crucial to our maintaining control over conquered territories.
At the base of the command platform, a lone figure waited patiently in the shadows. Harar bade an attendant prepare libations for himself, the tactician, and the figure below. He sipped his drink while he considered the tactician's appraisal of the spoils of battle.
What do the seized documents have to say about the Jedi?
Harar asked after a moment.
Curiously little, Eminence.
Resolute footsteps trespassed on Harar's response. Their source was a young female of severe beauty, whose long, shimmering garment accentuated an already lean frame. A turban encased most of her raven hair, and iridescent insects shone from the borders of her robe. Long strides carried her boldly to the foot of the command platform, where she folded her arms under her breasts and inclined her head and shoulders in a deferential bow.
Welcome, Elan, Harar said pleasantly.
Elan lifted her head. Wide across the cheekbones, her face tapered to a cleft chin. Ice blue, her eyes swam in a sea of lavender and maroon swirls, and her nose was wide and almost without a bridge.
Your pleasure, Eminence? For the moment, only that you join us.
Elan glanced over her shoulder. Accompanying her was a diminutive creature of motley countenance and a peculiar manner. Made piebald by an arrangement of short feathers, the trim torso supported two thin arms, each of which ended in graceful four-fingered hands. Willowy ears and twin antennae corkscrewed from an elongated, modestly disproportionate head, whose rear attenuated to a finely feathered ridge. The slightly concave face was slant-eyed, wide-mouthed, and delicately whiskered. A pair of reverse-articulated legs and splayed feet propelled the creature in agile leaps.
Your familiar is also welcome to join us.
Elan glanced at the stranger standing nearby, then reached for her companion's right hand.
Come, Vergea.
Abruptly, Harar's cushion rose from the command platform and carried him out over the steps.
We will now speak to the matter at hand, he announced.
Elan made her eyes alert with interest and squeezed Vergaer's hand.
"Thus far, our campaign has been blessed with easy victories," the priest began. "Worlds crumble and populations fall at our feet. But while I've no doubt that we will someday rule these species, I fear we'll encounter great difficulties in altering the way they think. Something other than superior weaponry will be required to accomplish that." He gazed at Elan. "Our chief impediment is a group that calls itself the Jedi. Think of them as a kind of moral police force. Small in number, but very influential."
Elan glanced briefly at Vergaer and once more squeezed her hand.
"What sort of gods do these Jedi worship?" she asked.
"None to speak of. Rather, they draw spiritual strength from a pervasive reservoir of energy known as the Force."
"And you have some strategy for subverting or nullifying this Force?"
"At the moment, no. However, there may be something we can do about the Jedi."
Harar indicated the stranger at the foot of the stairs.
"Elan, this is one of our field agents, Executor Nom Anur. Aside from being instrumental in helping secure a foothold in the Outer Rim, Nom Anur has managed to recruit agents from among the native populations and carry out many acts of sabotage and subversion. He's taking time out from his usual duties to oversee a project he and I have planned."
Elan leveled an appraising gaze at Nom Anur as he climbed the stairs to stand before her.
"Dressed in an Uglith mascar, this one could easily pass for a human," she whispered to Vergaer.
"He's an ambitious one, mistress,"
Vergaer whispered back.
"Take care."
Nom Anur bowed to Harar, though not as deeply as he might have, then spoke.
"Before the invasion commenced, and as a means of testing what we were up against, I seeded several worlds with a variety of illness-producing spores of my own design. One class of spores, a Kum variant, met with success, causing some 100 individuals to fall ill and die. Save for one. A human female Jedi Knight. Neither self-propagating nor contagious, the malady has not spread to the other Jedi."
Nom Anur scrutinized Elan.
"By all accounts, the human remains gravely ill, but she has thus far managed to survive, I assume by drawing on the Force. Her resistance, however, is a blessing in disguise, for I feel certain that we can make use of it to get close to the Jedi."
"Infiltrate them, you mean?"
Elan said.
"Assassinate them,"
Harar answered from his cushion.
"Or at least as many as possible."
Elan looked from Harar to Nom Anur and back again.
"What part am I to play in all this?"
The priest moved forward until he was hovering before her.
"One for which a priestess of the Deception sect is uniquely suited."
Han stood on the brink with the tips of his knee-high black boots projecting over the edge of the natural bridge. The voices of his friends were distant enough to be indistinct. That section of the bridge lacked anything in the way of a railing, and nothing stood between him and the abyss.
"You'll want to watch that first step, fly boy," Leia said from behind him.
Han gave a start but didn't turn around.
"Funny thing is, ground zero's always a lot closer than you think."
Leia's footsteps drew nearer.
"Even if that's true, you might want to consider a sturdy pair of repulsor boots."
He aimed a skewed grin over his shoulder.
"No need to worry, sweetheart. I'm already down there."
Leia came alongside him and glanced warily over the edge.
"And I thought the view from our apartment was unnerving."
She took gentle hold of Han's arm and eased him back from the edge.
"You're making me nervous."
"That's got to be a first."
He forced a smile.
"I'm fine."
Leia's brow furrowed.
"Are you, Han? Today couldn't have been easy for you."
He averted his gaze.
"I wish I understood what I was feeling. I thought the ceremony would help put things to rest, but it's only made matters worse. Maybe if I'd been able to retrieve Chewie's body and there'd been some kind of funeral..."
He allowed his words to trail off, then shook his head angrily.
What am I talking about? It's more than missing out on some ritual.
Leia waited for him to continue.
I know I can't change what happened at Cernpadal, but I blame myself for getting us into that fix to begin with.
You weren't responsible, Han.
I was, he snapped. Who knows what kind of life Chewie would have had if I hadn't dragged him all over the galaxy running spice and chalk root and whatever else we could smuggle.
Leia frowned. Meaning what, Han? That you shouldn't have rescued him from slavery? Besides, don't try to tell me that Chewie didn't enjoy gallivanting around with you. You heard what Ralwa said. Adventure was the reason Chewie left Kashyyyk to begin with. You and he were two of a kind. Han firmed his lips.
I guess I know that. Still.
He shook his head mournfully.
I'm losing him, he said despondently. I know he's dead, but I used to be able to feel him alongside me, just outside the edge of my vision. It's like if I turned quickly enough, I'd catch sight of him. I could hear him, too, clear as day, laughing or complaining about something I'd done. But something's changed. I have to think long and hard to really see him or hear him.
You're getting on with your life, Han, Leia said softly.
He laughed shortly. Getting on with my life? I don't think so. Not till I found some way to make his death count for something.
He saved Anakin, Leia reminded.
That's not what I mean. I want the Yuuzhan Vong to pay for what they did at Cernpadal, and for all that they're continuing to do.
Leia stiffened. I can understand that coming from Anakin, Han, because he's young and hasn't figured things out, but please don't make me hear it from you. He shrugged out of her hold.
What makes you think I know any more about life than Anakin knows?
She dropped her hands by her sides. That's something I hadn't considered, Han.
Well, maybe you should, he rasped.
In the hold of the Yuuzhan Vong warship, 20 captives huddled inside an inhibition field, raised and sustained by 2 small blood-red Dovin basils. At the center of the mixed species group stood the Gotl Hakig priest, whom Harar had promised imminent death. The field's hemispherical outline shimmered like waves of rising heat, with Harar, Nom Anur, Raf, Elan, and her pet observing from the command platform. A youthful Yuuzhan Vong warrior wearing a wine-colored tunic entered the hold, paid obeisance to his elite audience, and approached the field.
An assassin,
Elan said to Verger in hushed surprise.
A mere apprentice, Harar amended, said to show little promise, though the task he is about to execute will escalate him in the eyes of many.
Ripples played across the immaterial surface of the inhibition field as the warrior stepped through its one-way perimeter.
Observe closely, Harar said to Alam.
A subtle gesture of Harar's right hand was the assassin's signal to begin. Swinging about, the youth emptied his lungs with a sibilant and protracted exhalation. The effect on the captives was almost immediate. To a being, they fell back in surprise. Then, in stunned realization, and finally in agony, clutching at their windpipes as if the inhibition field had been drained of breathable air. Smooth faces turned a ghastly shade of cyan. Others lost color entirely, or blackened as if scorched by fire. Limbs and appendages spasmed, and tufts of fur wafted from the hirsute. Sudden blood mottled the flesh, then began to seep and mist from burst capillaries. Some of the prisoners fell to their knees and vomited blood. The more resilient staggered about, lurching into one another, until they fell, writhing and gasping, to the deck. Only the assassin remained standing, but not for long. Knowing better than to draw a breath, he hurried for safety, only to find that the Dovin basils maintaining the field were denying him egress. He spent a desperate moment moving along the perimeter as if hoping to discover some gap, some oversight that would permit him to escape. Then the full awareness of his predicament dawned on him. Turning to Harar, he drew himself up to his full height, snapped his closed fists to the opposite shoulders, and inhaled deeply. Blood began to stream from his nose and eyes. Torment warped his features into a macabre mask, but no sounds escaped him. His body trembled from head to foot,
Then he pitched forward to the deck. All at once, the inhibition field began to teem with hundreds of spontaneously generated life forms, no larger than phos fleas. In crazed motion, they scuttled over the prostrate bodies and massed along the edges of the field, as keen on finding some way out as the warrior had been. Harar motioned one of his acolytes forward.
Capture a specimen and bring it here, quickly.
The acolyte bowed and rushed to the field. Reaching a gloved hand through the invisible barrier, he pinched one of the scurrying critters between his thumb and index finger and ran it to the command platform. Even before he had reached the steps, the frenetic activity in the field began to abate, as if the swarm had suddenly expended its energy and was dying. The acolyte delivered his tiny hostage to Harar, who pinched the jittery thing between the three fingers of his right hand and held it up for Elan's inspection. Faintly opalescent, the creature was a flattened disc from which sprouted three tiny pairs of articulated legs.
Botus, Harar explained. Both carrier and byproduct of the toxin, precipitated from the assassin's breath. They grow rapidly in the presence of abundant oxygen, but are extremely short-lived.
Your weapon against the Jedi,
Elan said knowingly.
A skilled host can manage up to 4 Botus exhalations, but in a sealed environment there is no defense, even for the host. Do you understand?
I understand that a host runs the risk of dying with his victims.
The toxic effect of the exhalation is very brief,
Nom Anor added.
A host must be in close proximity to her target.
Her target?
Elan said. Harar held her in his gaze.
We would like to arrange for you to be captured by New Republic forces. Commander Tela, while not entirely enthusiastic, has even agreed to afford them a victory in the process. Once in their custody, you would ask for political asylum.
Elan looked skeptical.
Why would they accept me?
Because we would convince them that you are a worthy prize,
Nom Anor answered. Harar confirmed it with a nod.
You would provide them with valuable information, information regarding why we have come to their galaxy and what we have left in our wake. You would also tell them of dissension among our ranks, of disputes that prompted your flight, as well as information of some strategic value, information about our next target.
Nom Anor placed himself in Elan's view.
Unfortunately, there is no guarantee that you will succeed in fooling New Republic intelligence. That would depend on you. You would begin by claiming to have information regarding the Kum spores I introduced. You would, however, insist on delivering that information only to the Jedi. But be warned, the Jedi possess a kind of divining ability. They would be quick to discover deception, even in one trained since youth to beguile and mislead. Thus, the need for a quick-acting toxin carried by a quick-thinking host.
Harar extended the pinched creature to Elan.
Quickly, Elan. Take it in your palm and clench your hand around it.
Elan stared at him.
Should I do so? I am committed.
Harar gazed back at her.
I will not command you to accept this charge, Elan. The choice is yours.
Elan looked to Verger.
How would you counsel me?
Verger's oblique eyes clouded over with sadness.
I would counsel you to refuse, mistress. And yet, you have long desired to be tested, to be given a mission worthy of your talents. Sadly, I know of no more unswerving path to escalation.
Harar glanced at the priestess's exotic pet.
Take her along, if it pleases you, Elan. She may even prove to be of assistance.
Elan looked at Verger once more.
You would accompany me?
When have I not?
Elan took the minuscule creature into her hand and closed her long fingers around it. When she relaxed her hand, the thing had been absorbed.
It will migrate to your lungs and there mature,
Nom Anor said, smiling.
You will know when the toxin has reached maximum potency. Then you will loose your four breaths against as many Jedi as you can arrange to be gathered in one place.
Ilan looked at Harar.
What then, Eminence?
What's to become of you, you mean?
Harar took hold of her fine hand, examining the palm that had absorbed the carrier.
Momamor and I will do all we can to monitor your whereabouts, but I cannot promise you rescue. Only exaltation. Should you succeed, you will either die with the Jedi, or face execution afterwards.
Ilan grinned faintly.
That choice is also mine.
Harar patted her hand.
Look to the world beyond for recompense, Ilan.
I envy you your imminent departure.
Mara rose from the couch to greet Luke as he came through the doorway of their suite on Coruscant. He met her halfway with open arms.
It's about time, she said, shutting her eyes and holding him close.
I would have been back sooner if Streen hadn't asked me to go to Yavin 4.
Trouble?
Could be. Now that the Yuuzhan Vong have occupied Obra Sky, they could discover the Academy. If that happens, we have to think about relocating the younger Jedi.
They had been separated for only a standard week, but Luke was alarmed at how delicate Mara felt to his touch. He considered trying to feel her through the Force, but feared she would detect him and resent the intrusion. Instead, he luxuriated in her embrace for a moment longer, then backed away to hold her at arm's length.
Let me look at you.
If you must,
she said, with elaborate sufferance. Her face was pale, and her eyes were underscored by dark circles. But some of the sheen had returned to her red-gold hair, and her green eyes sparked to life under his gaze.
What's the verdict, Doctor?
She asked playfully.
You tell me.
It hasn't been my best week.
Mara smiled wanly.
Things haven't exactly turned out as planned, have they? Even after the peace accord, I never doubted that we'd face challenges and go through the usual ups and downs. But I truly believed we'd be able to send any enemies of the New Republic running for cover. Now, I'm not so sure.
Luke nodded, wondering if Mara was referring obliquely to her own enemy. If so, her words suggested that she was losing confidence in her ability to prevail.
You want to talk about irony? My father told me a story that happened right here in the Meridian Sector maybe 12 standard years ago. Captain Skent Graff, human and proud of it, was half-perched on the comscan integrator console of the Soothfast's cramped bridge, one high-booted leg extended to the floor. His captive audience, slouched at sundry duty stations, were the half-dozen who made up the light cruiser's bridge crew. The sloping viewports of the ingot-shaped vessel looked out on cloud-blanketed Exodo 2 and its poor excuse for a moon, and some light-years distant, the luminous dust clouds of the spangled Veil Nebula. He's stationed aboard the Corbantis when the ship's tasked to investigate reports of a pirate attack on Ampliquin. The Corbantis never makes it to Ampliquin. It's quilled by a flock of smart missiles and left for dead in an ice chasm on Damanite Yor's B, not too far from here as the Minok flies. But then, along comes Han Solo and his Wookiee pal.
Captain?
The comm officer interrupted.
Jorin reports that their hyperspace orbiter has picked up a Kronau radiation event in our sector. Confidence is high that a large ship has reverted to real space.
Graff turned to the ComSec officer.
Scramble, Gauntlet Squadron, and go to general quarters.
Sirens blared throughout the ship, and garnet light began to suffuse the bridge. Graff swung to face the hollow imager, where the ghostly likeness of an enormous faceted polyhedron, black as onyx, was already taking shape.
Will you look at that thing?
Someone on the bridge remarked, as a real-time image replaced the hollow simulation.
Sir, bioenergy massing. They have us in target lock.
Graff engaged the chair's safety harness.
Brace for impact.
Effulgent golden light filled the Soothfast's forward viewports. The ship shook as if snatched and shaken by a giant hand.
Plasma energy!
the enlisted rating reported. Consistent with Yu Zhongfang ranged weapons. No damage to vital systems. Shields are holding.
Tell Gauntlet Squadron to steer clear. Main batteries, commence fire.
Blinding projectiles streaked into space, followed by lances of blue-green light, converging far in the distance with radiant strobing flashes.
Direct hit! Fire, Graf repeated.
Again, torpedoes and coherent light streamed from the ship, and explosions wreathed the enemy ship, vying with the stars for brilliance.
Fire!
Once more, energy streaked from the ship, but no telltale flashes followed. Graf studied the display screen.
Did we miss?
He asked in disbelief.
Negative, sir. Enemy vessel appears to have absorbed the energy. All guns, Graf said. Fire!
Light painted local space with such intensity that everyone on the bridge had to turn from the viewports.
Enemy ship is altering course, taking evasive action. All guns, fire!
Graf barked again. Multiple direct hits? Evidence of debris? Enemy is altering course again. Speed is diminishing. Graf twisted to the navigator.
Maintain pursuit. Stay on it.
Then, without warning, an enormous explosion erupted in the distance, saturating the display screens with white light. When Graf could, he stared out the viewport but could see no sign of the Yu Zhongfang ship.
Where did it go? Did it jump?
Negative, sir,
the enlisted rating told him. Debris is consistent with an all-out kill. A spontaneous cheer rose from the bridge crew.
Quiet!
Graf shouted.
Did we just get lucky or did we discover a weak spot?
Unknown, sir, but the vessel is completely destroyed. Graf removed his hat and scratched his head.
I don't get it.
Captain, Gauntlet Leader reports that the destroyed vessel jettisoned an escape pod. The pod should come into visual range any moment.
Graf turned to the display screen.
Full magnification.
The navigator pointed to a fast-moving glimmer of light.
There it is, sir.
Graf saw what looked like a cylindrical asteroid, a small portion of its aft surface faceted.
Could be a trap, sir, some kind of sleeper bomb.
Graf nodded grimly.
Engage the tractor beam,
but only to hold that thing at bay.
Commander,
alert Gauntlet. Tell them to scan for any evidence of weapons, but to keep their distance, even if it turns out to be harmless. I don't want it anywhere near this ship. And patch me through to fleet office.
A voice crackled from the comm unit.
Soothfast, this is Gauntlet 3. It's definitely an escape pod, probably Yorick Coral. Negative for armaments, but registering life readings. Request permission to investigate at close range.
Graf mulled it over for a moment, then said, Gauntlet 3, you are green to investigate, but stay sharp.
Affirmative, Soothfast, staying sharp.
No one spoke for a long moment. Then the speaker crackled back to life.
Soothfast, I got a peek at the interior. Looks to be two, repeat, two occupants. One appears to be female. The other... well, sir, the other is anyone's guess.
Back on Coruscant, Han stepped apprehensively into Eastport's docking bay 3733 and palmed the wall-mounted illuminator bar. A glow ring washed the Millennium Falcon in harsh light. Approaching the Falcon head-on, her boxy mandibles aimed at him, he recalled his first glimpse of the ship on the hut world of Narshada almost 30 years earlier. It was love at first sight for Han, for there was something singular about her. Han stood motionless below the starboard hexagonal docking ring, lost in time. The Falcon was so laden with memories, such a chronicle of his and Chewie's adventures and misadventures, that he could scarcely bring himself to look at her, much less board her. But after a moment, he entered an authorization code into a handheld remote, and the ship's ramp lowered toward him, as if daring him to enter. When he did so, he was like a man relearning to walk. Entering the starboard aft corridor, he continued on to the cockpit pod and reluctantly entered. He dropped himself into the outsized co-pilot's seat and sat for a long while with his eyes closed and his thoughts shut down. Chewie wasn't the only alien he'd flown with, but the Wookiee had been his only real partner, and he couldn't imagine piloting the Falcon with anyone else.
so he could either mothball her or donate her to the Alliance War Museum on Coruscant, as persistent curators had been urging him to do for 15 years. A museum was probably where he belonged as well, Han told himself. Like the Falcon, he was part of the past, and of little use to anyone now.
"Ah, Chewie," Han said out loud.
Then he lowered his head to his folded arms and let his tears flow. Han was on his way to Eastport's transport center when a voice behind him yelled,
"Slick!"
Without slowing his pace, he glanced over his shoulder, then came to a dead stop and spun around, grinning ear to ear.
"Now that's a name I haven't heard in a long time,"
he said to the stocky, gray-haired human who was hurrying to catch up with him. The man grasped Han's proffered hand and tugged him into a back-slapping embrace. When they separated, Han was still smiling broadly.
"What's it been, Roa? 30 years?
Honorable, good-natured, and generous to a fault, Roa had launched many a young outlaw into the smuggling business, including Han, who had worked for him for a time. Han, Chewie, and a couple of other smuggling associates had even attended Roa's wedding, after which the old man had retired at his wife's insistence.
"So, Roa, you still in import-export?"
"Sold everything, almost 10 years ago now."
Han studied him some more.
"Well, you don't look like you've aged a day since Runadan."
"Nor do you,"
Roa said almost convincingly. Han smiled lopsidedly and tapped his forefinger against his front teeth.
"Regrown," he touched his nose. "Broken and repaired so many times there's hardly any original tissue left. Plus my face is all out of whack. This eye's higher than the other one."
"And you think I come by my youthful appearance naturally?"
Roa asked theatrically.
"Don't tell me you're a clone, right?"
Roa laughed.
Next best thing, rejuvenation therapy coupled with some daily myostim."
He displayed a noble profile.
"I instructed the cosmets to leave just enough age to keep me looking distinguished."
"And you do, you old scoundrel."
"Besides, the treatments were Luil's idea, mostly."
Han had an image of Roa's rich-voiced, blonde-haired, elegant wife.
"How is she?"
Roa smiled weakly.
"She died a few months back."
Han's lips became a thin line.
"I'm sorry to hear that, Roa."
Roa didn't respond immediately.
"And I was sorry to hear about Chewbacca, Han."
Han was quiet for a moment.
"So, what brings you to Coruscant? I thought you liked wide open space."
Roa's eyes darted.
"To tell you the truth, Han, you're the reason I'm here."
Han felt a shiver pass through him.
"Somehow I expected you to say that."
Roa put his hands on Han's shoulders.
"What do you say we go someplace where we can talk?"
Han nodded. "There's a restaurant in the transport center." At the Spacer's Lounge, a courtesy droid showed them to a table on the patio. Bland renditions of 20-year-old jizz classics wafted from unseen emitters. For old time's sake, Han and Roa ordered flagons of Ebla beer. Halfway through their first, Han asked to know the purpose of Roa's seeking him out.
"Fair enough," Roa said.
"Do you remember a smuggler from the old days named Wreck Desh?"
Han nodded.
"Yeah, Wreck was a decent navigator, but he never impressed me as a pilot."
Roa took a drink and licked his lips.
"Sometimes you only know a soldier when he becomes an officer."
"Meaning what?"
"Wreck's gone over."
"Gone over to who?"
"To the enemy, Han,"
Roa said, leaning forward.
"Or at least to a group of mercenaries working for the Yuuzhang Vong."
"That can't be right. Wreck wasn't the traitor type."
"A group Wreck's fallen in with call themselves the Peace Brigade. Word is they're stirring up anti-Jedi sentiment and scouting our worlds where the Yuuzhang Vong can repeat what they did at Cernpadal."
Han's eyes narrowed in irritation.
"Why are you telling me this, Roa?"
Roa lowered his gaze.
"Because Luil died on one of the worlds the Peace Brigade softened up for the kill. She died in the first Yuuzhang Vong wave. I was one of a handful who made it out alive."
"So you're coming here. This is as much between you and Wreck as it is between you and me." Roa held Han's polar gaze.
"If I could deal with Wreck on my own, I would. But I'm more frail than I look, hon. Yeah, and who better to help you than me, huh? A guy who just lost his partner. To put it bluntly, yes.
Where are Wreck and his crew now? Han asked.
I don't know. But I know where we could go to find out. First stop would be...
Han threw up his hands. Don't say anything. If I don't know where we're going, then I can't tell anyone.
We'd have to leave while the scent is fresh,
Roa said. Han tugged at his lower lip and thought for a moment. Your ship's here? Roa looked surprised.
Of course, but you want me to pilot you? Now that's a switch.
Yes or no, Roa? Roa made a placating gesture.
Don't get me wrong, son. I'm more than happy to oblige. I just naturally figured you'd want to take the Falcon.
Han shook his head. As an occasionally smart-mouthed droid I know once said, the Falcon's better configured for running away than engagement.
And besides, she's become a ghost ship.
I always knew you had a soft spot for the high life, Roa remarked as he and Han climbed from the repulsor cab that had delivered them to the skyway balcony of the Solo residence in one of the administrative district's most exclusive neighborhoods.
Don't kid yourself, Han said. It's smaller inside than it looks. The door recognized Han and opened. Arms not quite akimbo on his webbed midriff and head tilted to one side, C-3PO was standing in the tile-floored atrium.
Why, it's Master Solo, and a guest. Welcome home, sir.
To Roa, he added,
I am C-3PO, human-cyborg relations.
Taking in the domed entryway, Roa whistled softly.
How long before I hear the echo?
Han frowned and turned to C-3PO.
Where's Leia?
In the master suite, sir. I was just engaged in helping her pack when she sent me downstairs to fetch this.
C-3PO held out a shimmer silk scarf Han had purchased for her on their most recent trip to Bimsari.
Pack? Where's she going?
Actually, sir, I am to accompany Mistress Leia, but have yet to be informed of the destination.
Han glanced at Roa.
You better wait down here while I handle this.
Roa nodded.
I agree wholeheartedly.
In the master's suite, Han found Leia laying out items of clothing on the bed.
Seems like every time I come up here lately, you're getting ready to leave. Maybe you should just keep a bag packed.
Leia froze on seeing him.
Where have you been? I have been trying to reach you all morning.
Han rubbed his nose.
Memory lane. Anyway, I had my comm link switched off.
He gestured to the open suitcase.
3PO tells me you two are going somewhere.
Leia sat down on the edge of the large bed and curled a strand of hair behind her ear. Ord Mantell, of all places. The refugee problem has become overwhelming. Han, food shortages, disease, families separated. Han cut his eyes to the suitcase once more.
Don't you ever get tired of mercy missions?
Mercy missions are what I do. I'm trying to help any way I can. Han nodded nonchalantly.
Actually, the timing couldn't be better, because I'll be away for a while myself.
Leia stared at him.
Away where?
I'm not sure.
Leia raised her eyebrows.
You're not sure?
It's a fact, Han said,
glancing down into the foyer where Roa was appraising a crystal statue Leia had picked up on Vortex. Leia followed his gaze.
Who's that?
An old friend.
Does he have a name?
Roa.
Well, that's a start,
Leia said facetiously. I don't know where you're going, but at least I know who you'll be with, just in case I need to reach you. She paused.
Are you taking the Falcon?
Han shook his head.
Feel free to take her out for a spin whenever you want.
Leia studied him.
Han, what's all this about?
We're just going to check up on a mutual friend.
And you have to leave immediately?
Han shot her a look.
Now or never, Leia. It's that simple.
He grabbed a travel pack from the closet, then went to the wall unit and began to rummage through one of the drawers. In a moment, he had hold of his 30-year-old Blastech DL-44. He ran his thumb over the nub of the front sight blade. Then he slipped the weapon into the bag along with some clothes. Leia watched him for a long moment.
Can you at least stay until Anakin gets home? You've been avoiding him all week.
Han kept his back to her.
You can tell him goodbye for me.
Leia moved deliberately into his view.
You two have more to say to each other than goodbye. He's confused, Han.
You tell him he shouldn't feel responsible for what happened on Cernpadal, but your silence and anger send the opposite message. You have to help him through this.
Han looked at her.
What's he need me for? He's got the Force.
He needs your love, Han. Even the Force can't grant him that.
She was about to go on, but she stopped herself and let her shoulders sink.
Forget it, Han.
You know what? Maybe it'll be good for you to get away for a while.
Welcome to Bagshow, Major Showalter,
Dr. Seychelles said warmly.
I didn't figure someone of your stature would come all this way.
Actually, I won the coin toss,
Showalter said.
I guess I can understand everyone's interest.
Showalter and Seychelles knew each other from Coruscant, where they had worked together in an intelligence safe house in the bowels of the governmental district, and had occasionally hobnobbed with the likes of Luke Skywalker, Han Solo, and Lando Calrissian.
So, where are our two prizes?
Seychelles led him through a retinal print secured door to a large one-way transparasteel window in the rear wall of the lab. Dressed in hospital robes, the two alleged defectors were seated on separate cots in the room behind the window, quietly conversing in what Showalter assumed was their own language. Falling on the Yuzhong Vong female, Showalter's brown eyes widened with interest.
I didn't think the enemy was capable of producing anything so attractive.
Yes, Seychelles agreed. She is a handsome specimen.
And the other is what? Pet or partner?
A little of both, I think. They're inseparable in any case, and the pet, for lack of a better word, seems every bit as intelligent as her master.
Her?
Indisputably. Perhaps of a species indigenous to the Yuzhong Vong's home galaxy. Or vat-grown, genetically engineered. Whatever she is, she has quite an appetite for our foodstuffs.
Have you been able to talk to them?
The Yuzhong Vong female, her name is Elan, by the way, speaks basic. She says she learned it as part of her training.
As what?
Seychelles grinned.
Are you ready for this? A priestess.
Showalter's thick brows beetled.
You're kidding.
He glanced at Elan.
I wonder if they're celibate.
I didn't think to ask, Seychelles said. But she sounds sincere about wanting political asylum. I ran a voice stress analysis just for fun, and the test results back her story up. She insists on meeting with the Jedi. She claims to have information about a spore-borne illness the Yuzhong Vong let loose before they launched their invasion.
Showalter scratched his head.
The pet likes our food, the priestess speaks basic, knows about the Jedi, and wants sanctuary. Next thing, you'll tell me they have a bet down on the Smash Ball finals.
He sighed with purpose.
Director Scour wants them transported for a preliminary debriefing. Discreetly, of course.
You'll be handling the relocation, Major?
Showalter nodded.
It's obviously a trap, Seychelles said. These two, I mean.
Of course it is. But this could be our only chance to interrogate one of them. And we're in no position to pass that up.
Welcome aboard,
Roa said as he and Han reached the Sorosub 3000's carpeted passenger ramp. A quick look around, and it was Han's turn to be impressed. He roamed about inspecting details.